The iconic Polystyrene was one of the great voices of punk rock and has become an inspiration for generations. With her brilliant imagination, highly original songs and perceptive lyrical vision, she had a thrilling day-glow moment in the mainstream before devoting her life to Hare Krishna and occasional solo releases. I was close friends with Polly in the last decade of her life, and she gave me this fascinating interview about growing up and her days in X-ray specs.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think... Oh, bondage! Up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
So, can we talk about what you first got into with music when in your youth?
Well, I've always been music. I've been doing music since I was at school, since I was 5. I started writing songs in the playground.
Yeah.
I started performing in the playground.
Yeah.
I performed at my school assembly, and I was told by my headmaster I had a great future.
Yeah, he was right.
I think I did the boat that they row, which was a Lulu song, I think. The boat that they row wrote Rock the Ocean. We did that on our last day of primary school.
Yeah.
So I've just been singing ever since I was a kid. I was in Fringe Theatre. I was in the...
Where were you doing Fringe Theatre at?
Sorry?
Whereabouts was that?
Oval House.
Right.
The Oval House, which is where I met my manager. Because he was at film school and I was acting in a play there.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then I...
What kind of acting was that? Was that like normal acting? Was it kind of more avant-garde acting or...?
Oh, yeah, it's just fringe, total fringe. It was like spontaneous acting. It wasn't even really a proper structured play, but I used to go to the drama classes there, and then I sort of started going to the Oval House, and we just used to watch Fringe. And then I started to do a bit in Fringe, and then I was in Bath, and I was involved in the Bath Arts Workshop. It was all before punk.
Oh, yeah, when was this, about 72, 73?
Yeah, in the 70s, and I was in... the Johnny Rondo Trio, which was a jazz quartet.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I was in that before punk.
Was this all in Bath? Yeah.
In Bath, in Somerset. And I was a DJ there as well, in the sort of local hippie pub, the Hatton Fair.
What sort of music were you playing when you were DJing?
Wild Thing by the Troggs, my favourite.
That's such a great record, isn't it?
That was my favourite. And then obviously we'd do maybe Diamond Dogs. You know, David Bowie's Diamond Dogs, and we'd do maybe Roxy music. I used to do that. I used to take it in turns with my friends.
Is that the kind of music you were into at the time?
Yeah, I was very much into... Well, Roxy music played at the Bath Arts Festival, so we got to see a lot of these bands before they were famous.
Yeah.
So that's, I suppose we were influenced by that. But that was also... We considered that was a combination of fringe, theatre and music.
Were you kind of a bit of a hippie then? Hippie-ish?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You know, the hippie movement, it was kind of probably really dead, but in England there were still lots of kids my age that were sort of post-hippies.
Yeah.
It's like you've got post-punks now.
Yeah.
So I basically just did that whole sort of hippie thing for a year, and I really did it for real, you know, like, bathing in streams and living on ferns and, you know, I just lived on the land. I did it for 1 year until the winter. And then I met lots of people and sort of creative people, and then I settled in Bath for a bit and got involved with the Bath Arts Workshop. I was just always around very creative, alternative people, really. And then I came back to London and I made some demos, which were...
Well, when did you come back to London? When was that?
Sorry?
Where was that? When did you come back to London?
I think it was about 74 or something, 74,
right.
75,
yeah.
Something like that.
So you're making your own music about this point now, you won't go back to London?
I was making it because I was just sort of getting together with different musicians in Bath. So it wasn't really my own music, like that jazz trio that I was in. I was really just a singer in that.
Yeah.
But I was still writing songs. So by the time I came back to London, I had some songs already written that I wanted to record. And I just write really quickly and easily anyway. Then I started working with session musicians and people from the Pretty Things.
Yeah.
And that whole thing. But I wasn't really on, and I did a demo of O Bondage before I did it with X-Ray Spray.
Oh really? So what was this, about 75?
Yeah, I did it with Gary Moore.
Oh really?
Yeah,
oh, I never knew that.
First time I'd ever, that was the original, but I don't know whatever happened to that. But yeah, I was making demos with Gary Moore and people like that.
So what was that like? Did that sound like the final? Was it like kind of slower version or?
Yeah, it was very slick because Gary's like an amazing guitarist, but
yeah.
It's a bit bluesy. So I didn't think it was the right sound myself. I always felt that the sound was too sophisticated, which is why I worked with. I formed X-Ray Specs because I just wanted it to be, because when they were all coming from progressive rock and really virtuoso musicians, and I was quite a bit younger than them, and I was into the three minute sort of instant, you know, amphetamine thing, really. I wanted it quick and fast and short because we were getting quite bored at all the progressive rock things.
Yeah.
With the endless guitar solos. And jazz. And I used to go and see that and used to think, wouldn't it be better if it was just like short and snappy and just fast and you don't talk that much to the audience. So, you know, I'd been around, done all my homework before I put X-Ray Specs together, and it worked for a younger audience. But I think as you get older, you change. And you realise there were some things in the progressive rock which was cool, which would be too pretentious and too boring, or sort of like up itself. But at the same time, when it's just, you know, 3 minute little riff, you know, which was like old fashioned rock and roll, like the Ramones, that also gets boring as well. Somewhere along the line, I try to marry the two things together.
Gary Moore, then did you go to Ireland then or something?
No. He's living in here.
All right, so you're in London, you're trying to get, so you're going out, as, what was the name of your...
I was just making demos, I was just working with these people in...
Was it under your real name then, yeah?
Well, yeah, I did something with GT Moore and the Reggae Guitars.
Yeah.
Some of them were actually playing on some of that translucent stuff that's on Flower Aeroplane. And, you know, obviously I liked reggae as well because I grew up in Brixton.
Yeah.
So I was heavily into that too. There really wasn't very much that I wasn't into.
Yeah.
You know, I liked all kinds of things, and it's just about being curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
And inquiring and sort of wanting to know, you know, and take a bit from this culture and a bit from that culture. And I suppose really that's what progressive rock was, except it got a bit too boring.
So you doing your clothes store at this point?
Sorry?
Were you doing your store at this point?
Oh, I did that sort of when I was more involved in actually putting X-Ray Specs together as a band. Because I always used to have a day job as well, so I used to be a temp, sort of typing, secretarial work. And then in the evenings, I used to go to the studios and make demos.
Yeah.
And then I got fed up with my day job, and so I tried to do that fashion thing.
Yes.
Go to market as my day job, and then do my music in the evening. And it worked quite well. I didn't make a lot of money, but it worked quite well because it meant that I had a lot of stage clothes to wear.
Yeah.
Selling them in the daytime.
So this is about, what, 76, is this, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know, can't really remember the exact dates, but I think it was about 76. And then 76 was to 77.
Yeah.
When I started playing at The Man in the Moon, which was next door to the clothes shop.
Oh, yeah.
So next door to Beaufort Market.
So when you were doing your kind of pre-punk kind of solo stuff, did you actually get a deal with that at all?
No.
No, so you just kind of shocked.
Yes, I did. I had a deal with GTO, which was Billy Ocean's label.
Oh, weird, yeah. Did you get...
I kept getting, because I'm sort of mixed race,
yeah.
It was mainly the artists that had black labels that liked me. Black artists that would be interested in me. So it would be, even though I wasn't really playing traditionally sort of soul-y music. I liked Motown, obviously. But for instance, it was the Motown people at EMI that liked "Say Bondage Up Yours," the final version.
Respects,
because I suppose they thought it still had a strong voice, a sort of a little bit of that kind of voice where it went high, although I didn't think it did. And I was trying to be really English on it and speak with a regional accent, so I didn't think it was. But yeah, it was people at Motown that liked it, at the Motown side of EMI that liked it.
So we're in 76 now, and you've got your clothes still going, and are you aware of punk coming along here?
In 76?
Yeah.
Well, I saw the Sex Pistols, but they weren't really punk then. Well, they weren't called punk. I saw them on my birthday on Hastings Pier. They weren't famous. They were doing Rolling Stones covers mainly. When I think Glenn Matlock was in the band then.
He would have been then, yeah.
Yeah. And they were doing Rolling Stones covers. So I saw them. I mean, the only difference between them and the people I was working with, say, like, you know, people that I was sort of mixing with in studios, were some people from, say, like, the Pretty Things, and they were all friends with, like, the Pink Floyd and Dave Gilmour, and it would be, they'd be with people like Led Zeppelin, those kind of, were the musicians that I was working with. So the difference between the Sex Pistols and the musicians that I was working with in the studios were the age. They were younger.
So you saw the Pistols in Hastings Pier, and so that made you want to, that made you think you'd get a band together, or just change direction, or did it have no effect at all, or?
It didn't have a huge effect, but it just made me think that I'd rather have a live band, because they were doing it live.
Yeah.
They were young, they weren't famous or well known, and it just meant that I didn't have to keep working with all these kind of quite well established session musicians that I was working with, where it was all studio. So I liked the idea that you could just go out, and basically they weren't very good, so I just thought, well, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be so polished. It should be a bit rawer.
So do you start putting the band together at this point then?
I did, yeah. I decided, I was already with a label, GTO, but I decided I just thought I wanted to have a band. And then I met John Savage.
Oh, I know John, yeah.
And he started taking me to, well, he took me to the Clash gig, which is just around the corner from where I lived in Fulham.
Yeah.
And he's also took me to the Roxy.
Yeah.
With Falcon. So really, he introduced Falcon into that punk world, and me as well, because it certainly wasn't a world that I belonged to.
So this is like late 76, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is. I can't remember the exact date. I mean, I don't know what they've got the date at the live at the Roxy, but pretty much I was playing, I only went down there once. I was playing the next week, I think.
Wow, so that's the amazing thing about that period, how fast everything moves, isn't it? So, as you might, could you just wait 1 minute? I've just got to turn the tape over. I'll just be back in 1 minute. I've just got to go into the room and turn the tape over.
Okay.
You playing in the Roxy. I mean,
yeah, literally.
So what song, did you have all the songs really, they're already written, aren't they, I guess?
Well, I was writing them as I went along. I didn't have all of them. I didn't have The Day the World Turned Aglow. That came a bit later.
But about the first set you played the Roxy, was that stuff that you had from
I had Bondage Up Yours, because I'd already done with Gary Moore. I'd already been working that one through with him. And I had Identity came a bit later, Day the World. I had most of them, but not all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I had 1977. So I guess that's when it was. It was 1977, because that's when I did Plastic Bag. So that will be the year. Because I mean, it's so long ago for me, I can't always remember.
Yeah, it's 77, yeah.
Yeah, so it must have been then, because that's when I would have written Plastic Bag. So yeah, it was 77. That's the date that I put in the song. I'll probably put that in so I'd be able to remember it.
Yeah, like a diary. So did you have the look as well already?
Yeah, I got the look pretty quickly. I'm not sure.
I mean, were you dressing like that before?
Oh, really? No. Well, a little bit. You know, we used to wear anything and do everything, especially when we were in that fringe theatre period. Because, you know, when Bath Arts Workshop,
yeah,
that's where that, you know, really started as far as dressing. Because, you know, we used to shop in flea markets, so you just buy this, a bit of that, and you just mix it together and create a look. And it was all about creating your look and a different look and not having the same look twice. You know, whereas now it's all pretty much, it's done for you, isn't it, teen fashion?
Yeah.
But there wasn't a lot of exciting teen fashion then, so we just used to create it. I mean, Bieber's had the most glamorous fashion, but she went out of business pretty quickly.
So your look was like very much your own look though, wasn't it?
Well, I remember before I went to, I had long hair, very long curly hair, so I always used to look a bit like Mark Bolan when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
That's what I looked like a little Mark Bolan type character. That's how I naturally looked. But then when I did the punk rock thing, I decided to cut all my hair off. Not because, I don't know why I did that. I thought it would just look better with the whole thing. I think I cut it before I went to the Roxy. I certainly didn't have long hair at the Roxy, so I must have cut it before I did the Roxy. I cut it before I went to the Man in the Moon. I remember exactly. I went to a barber's. I had it cut in a barber's in the King's Road.
Yeah.
I remember, yeah. But up until that point, when I was doing all the other music, I had all the long corkscrew hair because that's the way I used to dress. Just jeans, long curly hair and T-shirts. I mean, that's how everybody dressed. You know, that was the 70s.
Yeah. But your look in the punk days was amazing. It was like really original.
It was quite original at the time. I mean, it was. But also, I met that girl, Sophia Horgan, that was a fashion student. So she did my very first... I mean, some of it I did myself and had my own looks. And a couple of times I wore some of her things. And yeah, she was a first-year... She was obviously being very different and very influenced by David Bowie and Space Odyssey and also probably the 60s as well. So she made those weird foam zip dresses and all that kind of stuff with the big zips across the top, which was, you know, they were her clothes. And I was selling them for her in my shop.
Yeah.
So I had them anyway.
So you just started wearing them, yeah.
Started wearing them. And then she'd just come to the gigs and bring me a new outfit to wear, you know, backstage.
Yeah.
Literally, we just used to all just put it on and wear it. Because she used to bring it and, you know, she used to bring stuff for all of us, not just for me, but for the whole band. She'd just come along back after a gig, come backstage, and then we'd all hang out together. So we were like hanging out with her, and then she was clothing us as well at the same time. I'm not sure how much money she got paid, but I know I was selling some things for us, but I guess she also wanted us to showcase her clothes for her.
Yeah.
You know, it was just very open. There she was with her sewing machine and all her skills, and there I was with a few ideas and needing to having fun, really, wearing all this stuff, and it wasn't costing me, like, you know, I mean, I'm sure if I went round the corner to Vivian Westwood, it was...
very expensive, yeah.
Out of my price range.
Well, I like the way your clothes kind of complemented your music. It seemed to all fit together.
Well, I think she probably used to get, like, she'd come to the gigs and she probably got ideas from the songs.
Yeah.
As well, and so she'd make stuff that she probably thought that we'd like.
The lyrics are always really fantastic.
The lyrics?
Yeah, you always had this consumerist thing you go on about.
Well, I was into that at the time, specifically because I'd been in those Earth Fairs.
Yeah.
And I'd done all the whole technique back to nature thing. And then when I came into London, back
so what was London, what was the back to nature thing you were doing? What's that?
Well, I was doing back to, you know, I mean, like living on the land, like when I was doing the whole sort of hippie trail thing.
Oh, right.
English countryside.
Was this in Bath then? Yeah.
Before that was like Devon, Somerset. We were living literally in on the land, and we were eating ferns and drinking stinging nettle tea, and we were living, you know, we were living on the land.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So we did this hot for summer, we did that, and bathing in streams and just being complete sort of back to nature thing. That's what I call it, back to nature.
Trying
to live back to nature. So after doing that and then coming back into London, although it wasn't as consumer orientated as it is today, it still was, there were a lot of tacky things, you know, that sort of hit me and stood out, especially in markets and the level of plastic, cheap plastic. Maybe it was all covered in from China or I don't know where it was, but it was a lot of cheap, tacky plastic consumer goods. And so it just hit me in the face. So I started writing about it.
Yeah.
And just sort of commenting on it, you know, like nylon curtains and just all the things as well that I've grown up with in my youth, like Weetabix and Kleenex, which are not really... I mean, I remember I got into trouble with that with some of the TV stations saying that we were advertising.
Right.
And I wasn't. I was just trying to create a diary of the time. You know, like when you... It's like if you paint a picture and say you're you know, why should I be painting, you know, pretending I'm living in another age?
Yeah.
You know, like trying to be neoclassical when everything around me is modern.
Yeah.
Like painting a picture with words, so describing the environment, and maybe even being a little bit more futuristic, because I think that's why people think it's ahead of its time. You know, they think it still holds up today, because it's probably more true now, like songs like Artificial and those kind of songs.
Oh, even more, it's got worse. Anthem that's like got really fantastic lyrics. You want to talk about them a bit?
In O Bondage?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, that's why I did the diary, because I feel that a lot of people misunderstood O Bondage Up Yours.
Yeah.
They thought it was all about, you know, S&M and sex, and I'm sure a lot of people just thought it was a kinky S&M song. But and in a way, that is partly my fault that I wrote it in such a way where I left it open to the imagination, you know, what it could be and what it couldn't be about. But the whole theme of bondage for me, because I have to come from quite a religious background, it's in the Bible, it's like all the way through. And it's also in the scriptures that I studied from India about the bondage and the whole idea of liberation. The whole idea of being liberated is to become free from the bondage of the material world. At that stage, I hadn't really gone into bondage that far, you know, like the real spiritual aspects of bondage or incarnation or that. I hadn't gone that far. But I certainly had an idea of bondage through physical limitations, you know, such as slavery and suffragettes. I mean, you know, I grew up with all those images in history. In history class, you saw it, suffragettes chaining themselves to the walls of Buckingham Palace. And we just grew up with that whole theme. And then we often used to see slaves, you know, being chained up. And, you know, because remember, the anti-slavery movement started in England. It was the English that abolished slavery. So I just had all that imagery, and then when I saw Vivian Westwood, her shop was just around the corner from mine, and I saw all her bondage trousers, then that just for me, I don't know what she was trying to do, whether she was trying to be expressive or whatever, but it just symbolised all the other bondage elements that I'd grown up with, and so I wrote "Oh Bondage Up Yours."
Yeah, that's, I mean, I like that. I like the way the imagery is mixed.
Yeah, and then I did that bit about the consumerism, because I also found that bondage, not you know, I got Chainsmoke, Chainsaw, Chain Gang, or one of Chainsmoke, I Can See New World, Chain Gang, Chain Mail. That as well, because I definitely, that's why I became a hippie, really, because I was working in the fashion industry as a junior buyer. I could have gone on and stayed in that, and I just remember the rush hour and everybody. I used to sort of stand there with my friends, we'd be at Oxford Circus, and we'd be like having to go down the tube or catch the bus home. And it was like everybody seemed like they was in what I call wage slaves, which is, you know, it's not terrible, but it's like you never ever earn enough money. You always only earn enough just to keep you alive, and then you've got to go back to work the next week. You never really advance that far. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're in bondage like all the time, you know. So it's not much different than serfdom, except that instead of being on the land, the serf on the land's in bondage. You're a serf to big business. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's how I felt a bit, and to me, consumerism was like keeping that whole thing going, you know, because you have to build factories, and people have got to work in the factories, and it was one way you can say it creates jobs, but on another way you can say, you know, if you become a hippie or a dropout, as they used to call us, which I did, it means that you actually, you want to escape the rat race.
Yeah.
And that was around in songs like Bob Marley, wasn't it? He'd write things like, oh, what a rat race.
Dayglo's about then?
Well, Dayglow is the ultimate, isn't it, of, you know, basically it's that whole thing of just fluorescent and tackiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, just using all the images of artificial man-created things. Remember, because I grew up in a generation where we still had brown paper bags when we went to the local store.
Yeah.
You know, you buy cheese, it would be sliced on a scale, and it would be in a brown paper bag, and gradually you see this whole thing, you know, and it all started when they started using those fluorescent cards to advertise things, you know, and that's why I called it Dayglo. And then they started making Dayglo socks, and it was great for some things, like not getting knocked over at night, getting run down, and I liked it myself. I used to use it myself, you know. I used to like those pens. I used to buy all those Dayglo pens, and you can still get them. They were coming in from the USA. But there was this whole thing, and that Dayglo symbolised the shift of sort of from natural materials to really synthetic. And that's why I put, you know, synthetic fibre, see-through leaves fell from the rayon trees, because all the fibres, all the clothes, you know, you're not buying Egyptian cotton anymore, or you know what I mean? You're buying... do you remember Brine Nylon?
Oh, yeah.
Brine Nylon, yeah, British Nylon, all byproducts of oil, I think, coming up. So there's this whole new thing that was coming about, and, you know, I remember, like, in the 60s, I think it was, the late 60s, you know, if you didn't wear a crimpling dress, all these weird kind of things, and I had clothes made of that stuff in the 60s. About that, the shift and naming all those things, you know. So there again, it's just another painting of the creeping in of, you know, total, what we call modernization, you know, real modern synthetics, everything, you know.
It was just such a fantastic critique of things of the time, which never dated, and it really fitted that time as well, the way people were thinking and things. I think you captured it really well.
Well, I think that's what an artist is supposed to do, and I don't really think I was trying to say much more than rather describe. In other words, I think I was trying to be an artist with words as opposed to, you know, pictures, because I like art a lot. I wanted to be an artist, and I'm not a great artist technically. I don't have a great hand for fine detail. I'm good at designs and overall things and colours, but I'm not, you know, I could be a fine artist. So writing would be an easier way for me to paint a picture with words than it would be to do it with a paintbrush.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the skills, really. Maybe if I really worked at it and did developed it, but just it was a quicker, easier format of painting for me with words rather than pictures.
Yeah, it was what was effective.
So, it's visual. I think it's just also the way you think, you know, as well. I suppose maybe if you've grown up with... So if you look at old poetry like Wordsworth and all the romantic poetry, it's all more about feelings and emotions.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've grown up with television, and I don't think I grew up with it early on, but I grew up with it maybe we got a TV when I was about 8. So the eye's been trained, you've been trained to see things visually. So, you know, maybe not everybody has. Where I think a lot of the new pop songs are all still about emotion now. They're not really about painting pictures with words.
Yeah.
Not a lot. People like Bowie did a little bit. But most of it is about emotions, which is, there's nothing wrong with emotions, but I just wanted to do something that I thought was modern.
So the punk times, what was the actual life like? You toured, do you actually tour quite a lot?
We did an awful lot of live work. I mean, probably a bit too much. We certainly played lots of small venues regularly, maybe even 2 or 3 a week, I think.
Yeah.
We started out with a residency at the Man in the Moon, which was once a week. And then we'd get asked to play all over the place, and we just used to literally just do it. And then it just, when we went signed to EMI International, we weren't signed to EMI UK, we were signed to EMI International. But then we were asked to do a lot abroad.
Yeah.
Go to Germany and play, mainly TV, Sweden and play. And then Japanese people would come over, which is why I have quite an international following still, because I didn't play in all of those countries, played in several, but mainly on television and those kind of places, except for New York, where we played at CBGB's on the Bowery.
Oh, did you get to America then? Yeah.
Yeah, we played there, but, you know, it was never filmed or anything, so we don't have a lot of record, because we were all pre-video.
Yeah, yeah, it's a totally different time, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, okay, I think that's most stuff I'm going to need there. That's really good.
Is it?
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff there, yeah.
Oh, well, good.